You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's an absolutely gorgeous day today, but cast your memory back just a few weeks to July's heat wave when the unrelenting heat and humidity made everything feel a little miserable. In 1976, Great Britain suffered not just a heat wave, but also a drought that lasted for months, and that's the setting for Maggie O'Farrell's latest novel. One hot morning, Robert Reardon goes out to get the paper and never comes back, leaving his wife and three adult children to wonder where he's gone and why. Instructions for a Heat Wave is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Maggie O'Farrell to our show today. Hello.
Hello there. Thank you very much for having me.
How old were you at the time of the heat wave?
I was four, so it sort of formed some of my earliest memories. I do remember the world being in this very open, light-filled space. I remember standing on the back step wearing a sun hat, and not much else, actually, because I was four. And just the whole garden was filled with sunshine.
But is the heat wave one of those things where if you mention it at a dinner party, everybody starts telling a story?
It is. It's a very odd thing. It occupies a really interesting position in the kind of collective consciousness of Britain and Ireland, actually, because everybody who lives through it has a story about it. And this, it was one of the most useful things, actually, as a novelist, to discover this as I was starting the book. I would meet a complete stranger and they would ask me what I did, and I would tell them, and I said, oh, I'm working on a book on the 1976 heatwave. And it was astonishing. You know, it would be this big waterfall of confession. People would tell me, that was the summer I started having an affair with my neighbour, or that was the summer I decided to leave my husband, or, you know, which as a novelist, it's gold dust because, you know, you should never tell a novelist anything because they will use it. They will just store it away. But it's astonishing. Everybody has some kind of memory of it.
Well, the two examples you gave me are very dramatic kinds of examples. Mm. Did most of the things that people remembered during that heat wave have that kind of resonance? Here you have a man who leaves his wife and kids.
Well, it's interesting. One of the kind of starting points for the book, the kind of kernel that started it, was I was at a party and I was chatting to a retired police detective, and we were talking. I was telling him that I've always been fascinated by people who just leave their front door one day, just walk out and leave their lives behind them. You know, I always wonder, you know, what makes people do that, and why would you do it, and how do you get away with it? You know, it's always been a kind of slight secret fantasy of mine. There's something very seductive about the idea. Obviously, since I've had kids, I would never do it. But
Anne Tyler has written about a woman who does it on the beach.
That's right, exactly. Yes, I read that.
She just gets up.
Yeah, she just walks away and starts a whole new life. It's fascinating. So anyway, I said this to the police detective, and he said, just very casually off the cuff, he said the number of people who do that rises really sharply during a heat wave. And I'd already decided that I needed to write about a family, and I was going to set it in a heat wave. And just as he said that, the whole thing sort of fell into place for me.
Because it causes stress.
Yeah, well, I think heat, you know, I think extreme weather can have really interesting and strange effects on our behaviour. You know, I think we are much more responsive to the planet and, you know, geothermal activity and meteorological activity than we really confess. You know, we think we're in charge, we think we've built these cities, we've built aircon, we're fine. But actually we're not. We're very subject to those kind of external pressures.
And you're right about the heat wave. It lays them bare. It wears down their guard. They start believing, not unusually, but unguardedly. They act not so much out of character, but deep within it.
Mm.
So it didn't do that for you. You were 4 years old.
Who knows? I don't know. Well, I think heat is exhausting, and it's also, it sort of wears down your defences. You know, people are generally much more irritable in the heat. You're much more, those kind of desires and patterns and confusions are much closer to the surface somehow.
And did you intend for Robert's decision to disappear from the life that he's had for so long? Did you want it to be tied to the heat wave?
Yes, absolutely. I wanted this idea of this family who are almost dragged back together. You know, the siblings are all scattered all over the world. One's in New York, one's in London, one's in Gloucestershire, and I wanted them all to come back together. Two of the sisters haven't even spoken to each other for 3 years. And I suppose a little bit, you know, I always think that novelists are a little bit like Greek gods. You know, we slightly torture and torment our characters, but I wanted to drag all these people back and push them back into the sort of outgrown molds of their family and into the home in which, the very small house in which they grew up, just to see what will happen.
Does Robert take anything with him?
No, he takes some money and his passport, and that's it.
He's a retired banker, and retirement is a time when people start wondering what they should do with the rest of their lives.
Yeah, I think particularly for that generation of men, actually, I think retirement was a huge challenge, you know, because I think work and duty and regularity and bringing in the money was their kind of defining characteristic. I think much less these days. I think people have more leisure time and other interests. But in those days, certainly, I think men worked and at the weekend they rested and perhaps mowed the lawn. But, you know, and I think when your work structure is taken away, it must have been an extraordinary time. It must have been very frightening, I think.
But by all accounts, Robert is the one who always seemed lost without his wife, Greta, and he would wonder when she would return. How does Greta respond to her husband's disappearance?
Well, I was quite interested in the structure of marriages in those days, you know, marriages that were sort of formed post-war. I think they were still in very much a traditional mould. You know, Greta stays at home, she has the kids, she cooks the food.
All the way into 1976?
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. It's certainly in that kind of household, yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's very, very traditional, almost kind of Victorian values, and the man is there to bring in the money. And I think, you know, I think about the time of retirement, you know, obviously things shifted and changed. And also, you know, I think perhaps people were feeling the sort of first reverberations of feminism happening in these suburban homes. You know, there was a kind of awareness that there was something else out there. There was some other kind of alternative. But certainly Greta and Robert, I suppose these days we'd call them very codependent. You know, Robert's very shy. He relies on Greta. Greta's incredibly garrulous and sociable, and she loves to chat and loves to talk. And I think she kind of provides the social framework of the family, and he provides the sort of values, tradition, and the money, I guess.
You've described Greta as a character who demanded to be written. What was it about her that wouldn't let you go?
Well, it was funny, actually, Greta, because Greta's one of those people who, she's a very, a lot of people have said to me she seems like a very typical Irish mammy, and she's just one of those people who just never stops talking but doesn't actually get to the point of what she really wants to say. Very, very, you know, she's got a huge heart, she's very much larger than life, but I think if she was your mother, she'd be really quite irritating.
Well, you said that she was she's a typical Irish mother, you said mammy?
Yeah.
The Reardons are Irish immigrants, and Greta tried to ensure that her children would feel a connection to their Irish heritage. Mm. The British are often uncomfortable with the Irish, even when they're successful in London or one of the other big cities.
Well,
I guess Liverpool's
yeah.
the only place where the Irish seem to be able to find some kind of a beachhead.
Yeah, Liverpool and Glasgow. I think they're traditionally very, you know, there are a lot of Irish people in those places. I mean, I think these days, you know, I think with the peace process, that relations between Ireland and Britain are at a kind of, you know, I'm kind of at a pretty good point. But I think in the 70s in particular, it was at an all-time low, obviously, because of the troubles and, you know, there were the pub bombings and there was Bloody Sunday. You know, I think things were pretty bad, actually. I mean, I remember in my childhood, we put up with an awful lot of abuse and questions and, you know, really terrible anti-Irish jokes. And, you know, a relative of mine was thrown out of a shop because she had an Irish accent. My dad was asked quite regularly if he was in the IRA. Just, you know, I mean, amazing. You know, people just think it's okay to insinuate that someone's a terrorist in normal conversation. So, no, I mean, we grew up very much with the consciousness that we were, you know, that there was a lot of tension and that we were a kind of a race of people, you know, with our surnames and the way we looked. People were often very hostile to us. We just got used to it, I guess.
But the youngest of the Reardon's children has a very Gaelic name, Aoife. Mm. It was spelled A-O-I-F-E.
Yeah, it's now, Irish for Eve.
They have three adult children, Michael Francis, Monica, and Aoife. And they, as you said, they come home to their mother to deal with the crisis. Michael Francis and Monica were born within a year of each other, but Aoife was born 10 years later. Do you think that the architecture of a family, birth order and age gaps, can dictate the relationships between the siblings?
I think definitely. I think there's no question about it. I think the fact that Monica and Michael Francis are what you call Irish twins. They're born in the same year. Makes them, you know, I mean, they're in the same class at school. They're almost like twins, but not quite. And I think, you know, I think it's interesting in a family to have a large age gap. I have quite a big age gap between my kids. There's 9 years between my first and third. And I think you kind of occupy a very interesting position because you're sort of like a sibling, but sort of like a parent as well. You know, I can see that developing in my own family. But inevitably, I mean, you can't ever escape sibling order.
And then when kids get older, then the whole relationship with the parent can blur a bit too, because as adults, they're seeing their parents differently.
Well, this is one of the things I wanted to address with the book. because I've been interested in getting older. Now I'm 40 now, and I think one of the interesting things about getting older is realizing that those sort of relationships with your siblings and your parents you think are set in stone, and you think throughout your teens and your 20s it's just the way it is. But then I think adulthood brings lots of different pressures, you know, with mortgages and marriages and careers and children, and you know those pressures can exert interesting, you know, shifts in those dynamics, and things start to change.
Well, Monica and Aoife haven't spoken in 3 years, and at the beginning of the novel it isn't quite clear why, but then Aoife and Michael Francis, on the other hand, were always close. Do they fall back into those patterns when they find themselves together again?
Well, I think yes and no. I mean, I find when I return to my family home, I walk in feeling an adult, and after about 2 hours, I feel like I'm slightly retrogressing. You know, with every passing minute, I feel like I'm becoming a teenager. And I think, you know, I've heard other people say this as well. So I think you can walk into your family home feeling, you know, like a confident person, and suddenly, you know, you're back the way you were. It's a very strange flip.
There's also the matter of people bringing their own personal problems into a situation like this. Here, their mother has a big problem. Maybe the whole family has a crisis, and they're dealing with their own marriages and other things. Aoife has moved to New York and hasn't kept in touch with the rest of the family. Mm. You've said that you'd like to live in New York. Is there something about the city that draws you?
I think, oh God, it's where to start, really, why I love New York. I think it's very multicultural, and it's very beautiful. And, you know, there's so much going on here. Any time of the day or night, you could go and see a movie, you could see a happening, you could see a gallery. I think, no, I would love to live here one day.
Well, nothing, I imagine you can. Other British people do move here. But you moved from London, which has most of those things, to Edinburgh.
That's right.
Which has fewer of those things.
That's true. Yeah, we moved about 3 years ago. And I really miss London. It feels like the place that's most like home to me. But yeah, Edinburgh seemed to be the right place for us at the right time.
But this isn't just a plot book. Throughout the novel, there are these lovely observed details, like how a stain got on the carpet, or the trinkets that have been accumulated from junk shops and church sales. Is that how we know a place or a home?
Yeah, I often think that you know your home in sort of detail. It's the kind of micro level. You know, you can. I find it very odd when I visit my mum and I can open a drawer, and inside will be a tablecloth I remember from my childhood. I can find a button that I remember having, you know, sewn onto a pinafore when I was a really young child. You find all these very strange, you know, shortcuts or tripwires to your past. Things, you know, you never even think you might remember will suddenly come back to you. So it's a very odd psychological place to be.
You also mentioned earlier that you were interested in the way a family would be seen in 1976. Were you interested in exploring the social changes that have taken place since 1976? I'm thinking of that, and then also if his learning disabilities might be discovered and addressed today. Air conditioning was pretty common in the United States at that time, but in London, less so in 1976.
Still not, actually, I have to say. Yeah, I mean, certainly, I wanted to write it very much.
Global warming is going to change that, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Maybe you're right. Yeah, I was interested in writing a kind of historical or period novel, but very much from the time in which I was addressing. I didn't want to write with the kind of knowledge that we have now. I didn't want to kind of write a sort of retrospective, nostalgic book. That wasn't the kind of period novel I wanted to write. I wanted to write it in the moment. It's all in the present tense without the kind of benefit of hindsight, I suppose. And certainly Aoife, she, of course, has what we now recognise almost instantly as dyslexia. But when she was a child in the 50s in London, no one had ever heard the term. You know, no one understood it. No one appreciated it. They just think she's thick or obstinate or, you know, has a kind of weird refusal to learn. And so Aoife doesn't know what's wrong with her. She has no idea why she can't read and write. You know, I think dyslexia. My son, while I was writing the book, was diagnosed as dyslexic. And although he has a very different type to Aoife, it's the most heartbreaking thing to watch a child struggle with something that, you know, almost everybody around them can just do. Everybody else, it comes easily to. And for some reason, there are some kids who just can't do it. So I was fascinated in the idea about what would happen. Because, of course, nowadays, you know, you instantly get fast-tracked to learning support and there's all sorts of help available to you. But
Schools have LD programs.
Yeah, I mean, people pick up on it very early. Thank goodness, you know, thank goodness that people are caught now. But you know, I suppose the novelist in me was asking, what if this didn't happen? What if, you know, you were in a time when nobody understood this condition?
This is your sixth novel. Do you see certain themes that connect them?
Well, it's funny. I don't know. I mean, to me, I suppose my books feel like my children do. They're very, very different. And I think everyone has a different challenges. And
Is the next book going to be dyslexic?
I don't think so. I don't have dyslexia. I have other problems, but dyslexia is not one of them. but they all feel very different to me, I suppose, in a way. And they each have, you know, different. I mean, it's funny when you have one child, you think, okay, I can do this now. And then you have another and you realise they're all totally different. And I think novels are very similar. They each have a kind of different learning curve.
Maggie O'Farrell is the author of After You'd Gone, winner of the Betty Trask Award, My Lover's Lover, The Distance Between Us, winner of Somerset Maugham Award, The Vanishing Act of Esme Lennox, and The Hand That First Held Mine, that's the winner of the Custa Novel Award. Mm. I don't know if this is going
to
win an award, but
there's
a good chance. It's called Instructions for a Heat Wave, and it is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.